Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. Made with a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. To learn more, visit rt11.com.
Hello, and welcome to Snacking Tunes. I'm one half your host, Greg Bresnitz. On today's show, we are joined by Tim Weichman, award-winning Boston chef and musician. We talk about traveling the world with his dad, falling in love with food and music, and lessons from his pandemic pivot. Tim also brings his electric guitar to the show and lays down a couple of tunes for us. Then we dip into the archives with a performance from Moonhooch. So sit back, relax, and here's another episode of Snacky Tunes on HRN.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm your host, Greg Bresnitz. On today's episode, we have Tim Weichman from the great city of Boston joining us very specially with his guitar. I'm very excited. It's not often that we have our chef or food guest come on and play music, but as we get into his history, you'll see why we made the ask. Tim, welcome to Snacky Tunes.
How are you doing? Psyched to be here.
I'm good. You know, the first question that we ask everyone kind of after this unbelievable 15, 16 months is just, how are you doing?
We're good. We're happy to still be here, and we're happy to still be doing what we have done for a long time. We have two restaurants and a bakery, and we're just really psyched the pandemic is in the rearview mirror for us, and mostly, and you know, staying positive and really learned a lot of things, really grateful about what we've done in the past, and just taking it one day at a time, kind of, and being really happy to go and cook and be open, frankly. You know, just pretty happy, you know.
Absolutely. Let's go back. You are a first generation German American.
Right.
You spent your time between Massachusetts and Switzerland. When you were younger, you traveled all over the world with your dad, who introduced you to international cuisine. What were some of the dishes that you remember eating with your dad that kind of sparked your beginning passion for food?
Right. My upbringing is very just not that average, I guess. But, you know, my parents are both Germans, and they moved to Cambridge to work at Harvard. And in that, my father was he ended up traveling for Harvard, and then he brought his kids with him. So that was me. And for whatever reason, I just had this, you know, I fell in love with food really quickly, really early, and with music. And I was exposed to a lot of different food just by going to different countries. And, you know, we had a home base in Europe, and we were also in Massachusetts, but it just became like a thing where wherever I went, you know, he would say, you want to try this, you want to try that. And I gravitated towards food. If we were in Chile, I remember eating like these shrimp soups, or when we were in Japan, you know, it was fish for breakfast. And I couldn't understand that as a 4-year-old. But, you know, it really opened my palate at that memorable age. And that it just sticks with you forever when it's really young and you're exposed to something like that. So, you know, I grew all the way into obviously being a chef now. So that's kind of the backstory on it, and why I love it, you know, and why I love the breadth of the field, basically. You know, like it's there's so many things you can do in food, and so many different ideas you can have, and you can be so creative. And that's kind of been our career, you know, trying to be as colorful as possible and try different things, and you know, push ourselves to do new things. You know, that's my zone.
Absolutely.
That's my zone, is okay, I've tried that. Now I haven't done that, so why don't I try that? And as hard as it is, and you know, as much as we struggle sometimes learning a new craft or trade or part of the restaurant business, you know, it's still fun to do that stuff. You know, it's that's who I am.
Yeah, as we found on this show, so many chefs before they really got serious about cooking were musicians. We have talked about how they're both creative disciplines. They're ways to connect with people, not necessarily through words, but through articulation of either notes or ingredients. You didn't just get into right. music. You traveled and toured professionally. Where did you go?
Right.
And what did you pick up? And what was some of your favorite styles of music?
So for me, you know, my story is I couldn't really decide which career I wanted to have. You know, I did go to university, and I was just kind of like 18, 19, 20, 21. I just really didn't have like laser focus with my life. You know, I love to do a lot of things, and I was a creative person, but I played guitar the whole time as a child. And I also love music from all the places we went to. And I just worked in restaurants. That was just like how I worked in the summertime and made money. And I like the discipline of work. But, you know, I definitely loved playing music. And I studied with a really good teacher named Richie Hart, who's a jazz musician from New York, who had played with all the, you know, really the whole songbook of like Blue Note Records. And I was like, I just want to try to play and sound good and play like that. So I practiced a lot and he really taught me a lot. And then I was hired by this gentleman named Ron Levy, who was in the B.B. King band for 10 years and played with Albert King. And I love blues and jazz. So I went on tour with him for about a year and a half, like in the early 2000s, and played with some really spectacular musicians. And it was an unbelievable experience. And talking about it now, it's, you know, it's just an amazing experience that I was lucky to have, really. And then I said, you know, but then the music business, and I was like, you know, if I get my own restaurant, I can probably, you know, the travel part of being a musician, I just didn't love as much as music itself. I think that's what I finally have come to. And I loved building my own restaurant and having people come there and having that consistency, you know. So that was really the difference. But I still, you know, in that restaurant, I ran my own jazz trio with a good friend of mine, Dean Johnston, who's in the band called Club Delph. It's a great band, really good musicians. And I had my own jazz trio, and right now I'm even talking about doing it again because the music industry, the local music industry, has really changed since the pandemic. So I was thinking about having a live music in my pizza restaurant again. And that's just like, I might do that and probably going to do that. So, you know, it's always there for me. It's just always like, and it's always a change of scenery from that one area, which is food, you know, because you get really into food, but then it's also nice to just be like, okay, this is like a different zone. you know what I mean? Like just to switch it up.
Yeah, absolutely. In the process of songwriting and creating dishes, where do you find similarities?
Well, for me, the two things that overlap for me were jazz and French cuisine. So like I learned French cuisine. I worked with these really, I like wrote all these letters to these guys. This was way, way back. And they said, you can come work in our kitchen. And I don't even know if this happens anymore, but like, you know, I was the stagiaire at Taillevant. I was the stagiaire at Robuchon. And, you know, those are very complex kitchens. They have, you know, so many components on every plate and so many cooks and chefs putting all those components. And that is fine dining. And I was really drawn to that. And it was like, that's really similar to me to how jazz works or how classical music works, which I don't know classical music, but you know, it's a study of harmony and layering and allowing many different things to go on top of each other. And you just kind of get into that sphere and your mind just like it allows your mind to go as far as you want to go with it. And that was attractive as a young chef, you know, fine dining being that way. You know, you can take lemongrass, you can take coffee, you can take a mushroom that, you know, and you can just go with whatever idea you have. You're not fixed in a rule of like, you know, on my bagel, I want cream cheese. You know, that's kind of, which I love because I have a bagel shop, but you know, that's where I've come to, the simplicity. But when I started, definitely jazz and French cooking or fine dining cooking is really similar in my mind, you know.
Incredible. Sense? Well, you have a good, perfect answer. You have a guitar in your lap. Normally we would cut to a song from our archives, but we've asked you to play a couple songs for us during our musical breaks. What song are you going to play for us first?
I don't know. I think I'm just going to play some blues for you. You know, I got a great, old Fender Twin, and I have a great guitar, from my friend Chris in, Austin, Texas. He builds these guitars, and I have two of them. It's called Bell Tower Guitar, so it's a custom guitar. And it's a lot of fun. So we'll just play, you know, a little shuffle or something.
Welcome back to Snacking Tunes. Tim Weichman from Boston playing us some rhythm and blues, Chicago style. I want to get into your current restaurant empire or growing empire. You know, you opened up a restaurant in 2007, but Brown really opened up in 2013 to really incredible reviews. It pulls on your German heritage. It's a beer garden. What went into the thinking and kind of what space was open in the Boston food scene that allowed room for this restaurant to open? What kind of spot did you fill?
So Bronwyn is my wife's name. And, you know, that's a very, very special restaurant. And it's carried us through the pandemic. And it's been our most successful restaurant. Maybe it's the most authentic to me. It has my grandparents' chandeliers in it. Maybe making sausage comes naturally from my fingertips. It does. I don't know what makes that place so successful, or because I've had many restaurants and I mean, almost all of them have been successful, but that one is just really special. It's just like I built a lot of the tables myself, and we just put a lot of care into it, and it really transports you to that feeling of Germany from someone who is German. So it's tough to put my finger on it, but it really, you know, we opened it in 2013. The restaurant landscape was really different. It's still incredibly busy today. I mean, we're just really thankful to have it and what it does. And it's unique. You know, we make our own sausages by hand, a whole lot of them. And you just don't see that as much anymore. You know, it's a lost art. It's a great place. You know, it's a great place.
It's so interesting to hear you say that you're not quite sure, because, you know, so many musicians, when they're like, hey, did you know that, like, when you wrote this song was going to be a hit? Sometimes they're like, yes, we knew, given to us from the ether, pulled from like our brains to our guitars. But a lot of the times they're like, no, we just wrote this song and we don't know why, but it just struck a chord with people. Do you have a similar feeling that, like, there was like a kind of divine intervention when you were making this restaurant that channeled its success, similar to writing a hit song?
Yeah, I mean, it's exactly what you're saying right there. Like, you have, as a chef, you think you have a good idea when you head out to the world to do it, but you don't know if it's going to be the second song on the album or the first song that people are going to love. As an artist, you get behind everything that you do, and it, you know, you love it 100% no matter what you do. You know, like, it's just, sometimes it resonates and sometimes it doesn't resonate as much. And that's, you know, that's just the way it is. I think film, if you interviewed filmmakers, they'd probably say the same thing, you know. But with Bronwyn, I can give you all of those things that, you know, it's a corner location. It's Somerville. Somerville, we were one of the first people in Somerville, to, which is now like totally exploded. It's so many different things as to why that restaurant really took off on a national stage and, you know, to this day is really busy. Yeah. I mean, I really, really don't know other than the authenticity and care, but we do that for everything we do, you know? So,
what's the soundtrack there?
Oh, for music? We don't play German music in there, and we don't, dress up for like you would in a traditional, you know, what you see in most German restaurants. We don't wear dirndls and lederhosen except at Oktoberfest. So it really bridged the gap of like, it's an urban restaurant without being like a clone of what would happen in Germany. You know, it transcended that. It's I'm having a hard time putting words to that, but that's really what it is. It's not a gimmick. Like it's not like a you know, it's not a Disney like world experience, you know, which is also fun. It really brought in the local, brought in the square, brought in the city of Somerville, and it maintained that cultural thing, you know, with large groups of people. Like it's a small restaurant, but like an 18 top will walk in the door. They'll just walk in because people think, you know, German conviviality, they think these things and it's loose and it's fun. And that's what people love about those kind of that, you know, that is how, it is how people get together in Germany, you know, it carries that cultural hospitality, so to speak, you know, and it's loose and it's not pretentious and it's all those things, you know.
In 2019, you opened T&B Wood Fired and then almost immediately had to pivot due to the pandemic. Tell me a little bit about the concept behind Wood Fired and then the bakery that you opened when faced with the challenge of a complete shutdown.
Yeah, so I mean that restaurant, we had a large degree of not the best luck in that we weren't able to establish ourselves very long. But we wanted a restaurant right next door to Bronwyn, you know, because we are not a large organization and we want to be able to just, you know, go to one location and one area. And I was like, you know, this is where I could use a nice pizza shop. And again, I love to bake. And I love wood and I love pizza and I love the simplicity of it and I love the craft of it. So we built the store and, it did really well until the pandemic hit, but it had a great bar scene. So we really had to pivot, you know, we had to decide what we're going to do. And we closed it for a while and we used the space to create the bagel store, like many places, which has been doing really well. And now we actually have this cool restaurant that wood fire oven runs in the morning for a Montreal style bagel. And then in the evening, we light it up higher to the 700 degrees and we cook Neapolitan pizza in there. So it really has a cool, like village, French village, methodology to it. There's no gas cooking in there. Everything's done in the wood oven. And I love that, you know, that's just like a cool part of cooking that I love. You know, kind of, I've gotten away from fine dining, and that's where I landed, and that's what I like to do. You know, I like to go in it and work the wood oven. You know, because I've done the whole brigade and all the people, and I've, you know, this is my current like, you know, what I like to do is just like throw some wood in the fire and cook a bunch of pizzas. It's simple, but it's delicious. It's very laissez-faire. You know.
And we've seen this. It's really interesting. I think one of the trends is, and usually it's two different businesses, but it's so interesting to see that a nighttime, maybe dinner restaurant is now using its space for breakfast, or to be able to shelter two different restaurant concepts in one permanent place. As the owner of both, I mean, do you have, how are you able to change the vibe or change the scene for the breakfast place and to the dinner place? Do you have different music? Is there different napkins, culturally, well, logo, et cetera? Yeah. Like, how do you create two different worlds, or are they very similar?
Well, you know, again, the bagel restaurant was a pandemic response, you know, 100%. It's not like it was my next big idea. It was, wow, my bar scene is gone. I don't want to lose this restaurant. What can I create that people can come pick up? So the bagel restaurant at this point is only a pickup restaurant in the morning. It's not even a cafe to come in. It's purely order on your phone, pick up these great bagels and the fish platters and the sandwiches. And it's busy, but we haven't opened it up as a cafe yet. You know, we've only reopened our pizza restaurant for about 6 weeks. So we're really just like easing back into that whole figuring out what to do with it, really. You know, I mean, I love both of them, and they work, so I'm going to keep them. And I like the food products, and I like that village story. I like the oven running all day. But, you know, that's definitely a result of being in a very difficult position, you know. I mean, there's no other way to explain that, you know. So we made the best of it. That's what I say.
Do you foresee like an afternoon sandwich program with like fresh bread to get from like the breakfast to sandwiches to food and just make
not an yet. I haven't program? Bridged the gap. I just close. Yeah, exactly. Like the third product, the transition product. No, I mean that you know they're we close the bagels at 1 o'clock. You know, and they of course you could have a bagel store open all day, but it doesn't make sense. You know, I still like making pizzas, and we built a great nighttime restaurant. So hopefully, you know, things will just get better. And, you know, it's all good. It's just, this was the story of what happened and how I, you know, my wife and I, how we responded. It was either that or like, here's the keys, you know, and here's the keys to the car, take it away, you know, like, and we had just built it. So, you know, it was a lot of like difficult choices, let's say, which is why I'm in a great mood today. Well, and why, when you first asked me, how's everything going? I'd say double thumbs up, man. You know?
Well, that is incredible to hear. I want to make sure we have time for one more tune, but Chef, it's so amazing to see you in a good mood. We did so many interviews with people in the last year and change where that was not the case. So, I mean, you know, it's obviously radio, but we're on video chat. So if I can just convey to the listeners the massive smile on your face and the air of relief, if I might say, that's emanating off of you, it's quite good. Before you tell us what you're going to play, where can people go to find you? How do they go to your restaurants? How do they have a bagel, then get a pizza, then get a sausage? How do they get everything?
Well, I mean, Bronwyn is there. T&B Woodfire Pizza is there. And Turin Bagels are there. They're all in the middle of Somerville. So you have to come to Boston. Currently, you can't come and see me play because I don't have anything together in that department. But, you know, that's where we are. And we don't really, again, we're pretty grateful that we're here and we're not really planning anything big and new. We're just taking it day by day and happy to be open and happy that people are coming out and appreciating what we're doing. Because for the first time, you know, in 20 years of running restaurants, it was like, wow, you know, we can't do what we've done for 20 years. So, you know, it's just a time to like, to be kind of psyched that the restaurant business is like mildly, you know, getting back together. Really, like that's it, you know, and to be grateful for, you know, just to be grateful for like having them, I guess, you know, because really, you know, and a lot of, and I know people did lose their restaurants. So it's like that could have been me. So it's tough.
You couldn't have said it better. What are you gonna play for us before we come back with the second half of the show?
I'm gonna play one of my original compositions. All right. This is a song written for this guitar, a Telecaster.
This episode is brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. From the moment Route 11 dropped their first batch of chips back in the early days of 1992, they understood their destiny as a high-quality producer. Instead of succumbing to the frenzy of mass production, they took advantage of their small size and made chipping a personal art form. The payoff was immediate, an incredible potato chip. With a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. In this world of uncertainty that we live in, Route 11 Potato Chips believe comfort food can be just that. Know where your food comes from. To learn more, visit rt11.com.
Welcome, Moon Hooch.
Yeah.
Hey.
You guys can move a little bit closer to the mic.
I have to say that you are my favorite buskers, and...
Thank you.
Let's step back. So we...
I can't start with compliments?
Well, no, you can start with compliments, but Darren and I were, you know, we live off the L train, and I transfer at 14th Square, and, like, I saw you guys play, and I was like, man, like, I see a lot of buskers, but, like, what are these guys doing down here? Like, this doesn't make any sense. They're a little bit too, you know, they're not playing a pan flute, and, like, I really felt that you guys should be, like, above ground. And then we started talking, and I was like, dude, I saw this band. He's like, was it Moon Hooch? I was like, yeah, it was totally those guys. So eventually we were like, we got to just get these guys on the show. And then I saw you play like a few weeks ago on a Friday night. I was coming back from dinner, and it was a literal just dance party at 14th Square. People were just skipping their trains just to dance. First off, how often does that happen?
Every weekend if we play there. But we don't play every weekend, so
right.
It's kind of irregular.
Yeah, recently we've been playing at Union, actually Washington Square Park, under the arch.
Who do I have to go beat up if they, like, move you away from my train stop?
Well, actually, it did happen already. The police has been cracking down all the buskers at 14th Street, Union Square.
Yeah, they're, like, they're trying to stop
all buskers. So lately, every time we played there, we were stopped by the police.
So let's step back. How do you become a busker in New York? And, like, is it official? Is it scheduled?
Well, the way we do it is very unofficial. We just sit up wherever and play. It's totally illegal.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there is like a program called Music Under New York, and that gives you like a permit to play. But you can't play on the subways, on the platforms. You can only play in the mezzanines.
Okay.
But the problem with this is the judges of the program are musicians themselves, subway musicians themselves, so they give themselves the permit. And we applied for it. We didn't get one. We didn't get a permit. So
is there a code of, like, is there a code? Because I feel that I saw you guys play there on, like, somewhat regular, basis. Like, is there a code, like, hey, man, we were here first, or it's like...
Oh, like yeah. Other buskers?
Yeah,
it's first come, first serve, really.
Well, it was really hard for us to, like, get accepted by the other buskers, because some of them do this for, like, 10 years.
Right.
And, like, I mean, there was definitely a couple of occasions where we almost got in fist fights.
Yeah. Really?
Well, James...
we'll leave that story for off air. But so what is the... I mean, what is the history of you guys? Like, how did you form and how did you decide to go underground? Like, literally. Well,
We all went to the New School for music together. And James and I were friends, but Wenzel and I kind of knew each other.
Wait, take it around the room, because we didn't make any
sense. Oh, yeah. James is the...
Hello.
He's the distant voice in the back.
Just the drummer.
I don't have a microphone.
Oh, no, it sounds good. It sounds good.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good?
Yeah, it's good.
It's picking up.
Yeah.
Right. And so James, I'm Mike.
Okay.
Saxophone.
I'm Wenzel.
Yeah, other saxophone.
Other saxophone. Yeah. And we went to school together. And James and I were playing, separately, and Wenzel was playing with James, and we were both kind of going down to the subway, but on like in separate groups, you know, just separate duos. And then one day we met in Washington Square, and James and Wenzel were playing Under the Arch, and I was with another drummer named Max, and we decided to play together, and a huge crowd formed around us, and we were playing housey dance music, because Wenzel has been producing it, and he said like, "Oh, I'll play in this key," something like that, and came up with a melody over it, and we got a really good crowd reaction, so we decided to keep going with it.
Yeah, I started just writing in the subway, on the subway rides to the platform, just little melodies and bass lines, just like I would do when I produce like an electronic song, like that kind of style, and showed it to Mike, and we just quickly learned it by heart and started playing. In the beginning, we only had like one or two songs, and like looping the same song.
it kept drunk people dancing.
Yeah, but I mean, if it's a subway platform, like you really probably like need like what, maybe like 22 minutes if it's late at night because the train's going.
Yeah, even less. I mean, 20. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I'm being generous.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, now we have like a full like I don't know 2 hour set. With, like,
I mean, you have a full record.
20. Yeah, we have another one ready, but we. We're going to work on it some more before we go in the studio.
And before we get into a song, where did the name come from?
Mike just blurted out one day. We were playing, we had no name, we weren't even considering ourselves a band, we were just all making money in the subway. And somebody asked us, hey, well, what's our name? And Mike just was in a goofy mood and said, Moon Juice. And we said, oh, that actually does sound like a cool name. And then we looked it up, and there were 8 bands called Moon Juice.
Of course.
And
obviously.
Then we went through the thesaurus, and we found a replacement for Juice.
I mean, it is...
And then Hooch, and then it made sense. Like, oh, it's like moonshine.
Or yeah. No, it's good. Let's get into a song. Yeah.
All
right. Let's do a song. Let's rip,
which one are you guys going to play first?
Number 7, this one's called. Or Take the L Train.
Yeah. Okay. Nice. I get the reference. live on Snacky Tunes, Moon Hooch. It's about to get loud. I think that is the loudest that it's been in here.
No.
No?
Immaculate.
Oh, Immaculate. Yeah, I guess they had amps. All right, second loudest.
So dancey.
Yeah, so dancey. I mean, so how much of does your electronic house music background come to influence in writing your songs now?
A fair amount, actually. We all started listening to electronic music. I started listening to electronic music probably about 2 years ago. Wenzel's been doing it for like maybe 5 years. Mike, about the same.
Have you? 2 years. 5 years?
What? Listening or producing?
Listening.
I've been listening to it.
I got really into electronic music when I started producing it. Like, that's, I think, when I got...
When was that?
I don't know. When was it? Like, on the cruise ship? 2008 or 7. 2008 or 9.
Cruise ship?
Yeah, I was working on a cruise ship, and I...
That was like 2009.
Yeah.
What were you doing? You're just going to drop that in there? Like, it's a comment. What were you doing on a cruise ship?
Well, I was actually working there as a saxophone player and flautist and clarinetist.
Oh, okay.
But my passion was not really the music we played there. It was just more like work, and I got to know the DJ of the crochet, and we just like started producing together.
Amazing. Yeah. So how did you go from busking to gigs, or were you also pursuing gigs like in clubs along the same time?
I think it's just that people see us on the train and literally drop their card or take our card or, you know, get in touch with us. And now we have a manager, so things are much easier.
Hey, by the way, thank you, Rich. He got back to me immediately.
Richard's the man. He's nailing it.
Yeah. It's much easier now.
Yeah.
I can imagine. So, what was your first gig outside of busking together?
As first ever?
I remember it. You know where it was?
I don't remember.
On the rooftop of... What's her name? The red-haired girl.
Oh, that's right. Randall Wendell. Oh,
yeah. Randall Wendell, yeah.
Holy shit. Was that the first ever?
That was our first gig.
In Williamsburg,
exactly,
that's right.
Yeah. Because we never played a gig before, and we were like really worried we're going to run out of songs and whatnot, and people are not going to like it.
Repeat trick like you do in the subway.
Yeah, exactly. Right. But it was really cool. Actually, people started dancing so hard, the roof almost collapsed.
Yeah,
that was not because people danced, the roof was shitty.
Yeah, okay.
it was definitely quite an experience.
And then, you guys formed when, exactly?
Summer of 2010.
Okay. Oh, so not that long ago.
No, we're newborns.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Not in 2 years, yeah.
So, like, just to go back to the subway, because it's such an interesting thing, we don't get to talk to too many buskers. Like, what was it, like, that you had to do to get accepted by the other buskers? And, like, what were some of the trappings?
You know, they used to come at us, like, we'd play and, like, a bucket drummer came, sat up next to us and started playing a different tempo.
And yeah, they were, like, real rude about it. Like, super aggressive.
Yeah, super sandbag.
So really aggressive.
That's aggressive.
And
that's not passive aggressive.
No, it's, okay.
No,
it's just,
and,
like,
and then, like, aggressive. We said something like, what do you want to play together? Or, like, do you want to... Just wouldn't respond. I'm doing this for 10 years. Do you see the marks here? That's because I've made them. I've been here for 10 years.
Oh, the marks as the people watch.
And you know, yeah, it got really heated, the situation, and we left.
We ended up just leaving. Like, whatever, man. You can have it.
You know, just
we're not gonna
go
fight
through
you
those situations
this.
Over and over again, and then the other buskers actually listen to you, and then they actually, you know, we start liking each other, and now I feel like. Like, the other buskers are our friends, and we say, hey, I'm going to come back in 1 hour. Are you going to be still playing? Oh, yeah, you know,
we kind of just schedule it. You know, whoever's there first, like, and then we're like, yeah, so we'll be here until 10. You know, you can have it then.
Huh.
And,
But so, like, all the people on, like, Bedford and everything, like, that's also illegal as well?
Everything.
Yeah, everything is legal.
Well, what about those people with the signs?
Well... You said that's part of the alliance, right?
Wait,
it's on the mezzanine.
The mezzanine with the music on the New York signs. Yeah, that's legal.
So what are the cops? Do they come and they're like, you guys can't be here?
It depends
on the cop. Sometimes the cops like our music and they just let us keep going. But sometimes they're like, they'll yell at us and be like, this isn't a club.
That's so crazy. I mean, I feel like... Yeah, I mean, I guess...
Oh, really?
The thing is that it's not like a strict law. It's kind of like...
Ambiguous.
Area,
ambiguous, yeah. Because we don't have amplification.
Right, that's the one thing I know. It's like no electricity...
Right.
But you guys are loud as shit.
Yeah,
so,
loud.
Like,
yeah.
The guy with the pan flute is definitely not gonna start.
He's got amplification.
Look at the one guy we saw, his pan flute still attached to a microphone that he used to play off of.
Yeah.
Which is kind of sad because it's like a yes-year thing, and you're not really gonna hear the theme to Titanic the same way without the backing tracks.
But
you guys are loud, so I can see how like they would be like, well. That's kind of
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, cops walk by and say, I can't even hear myself thinking. Stop. you know?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, totally makes sense. Just
so do you see, you know, as things progress, you know, leaving the subway and just playing more and more shows? Like, was this a stepping stone? Sure. Or
I mean, well, we have a residency right now.
How did the residency? It's at Knitting Factory.
Yeah.
Right.
How did that come about?
Well, I got in touch with them last year because we're doing warehouse parties, and those became too dangerous, too illegal,
too much,
and too big, and we didn't want to have the responsibility anymore. So we want to contact clubs to play in clubs. And after, you know, talking a little bit to the Knitting Factory, they finally booked us. And the bartender and intern, who was Richard, figured out that we didn't have a manager, and he always wanted to be a manager, and he's really talented as a manager.
I get it. So Richard was a bartender at
Knitting Factory, and the book he did booking.
And he did booking.
And then he got us the residency.
And he's still working over there?
Yeah, he
still works there too.
So pretty good.
Pretty
right?
good.
Yeah, it's
pretty
great.
Good.
It's
extra drink tickets, right? Huh? Extra drink tickets.
Well, we get a bottle of Jameson in the green room.
Yeah. Hey, we're the same writer. Same writer.
Well,
let's look at that song.
Wait a second. How does the fee get negotiated? Does he just kind of like look in a mirror and be like, "I don't know, man. It seems a little high." It's like, well, you know, they're a good band. They've been working hard.
No, he's not. He's not the manager at the Knitting Factory, so he has to negotiate with the manager at the Knitting Factory.
Got it.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Let's rip another tune. I think we can actually say rip another tune for this band.
Song from Miguel.
Yeah, that's why I've been saying it.
Yeah. Let's do it.
This next one is called "Song from Miguel." Miguel's a guy, really awesome man, who gave us our saxophones. Actually,
he gave them to you.
Yeah, all of them. So
what?
He's a man. Yeah, and they're like the best saxophones you can get.
Yeah.
So thank you, Miguel. Always.
Yeah.
Barn burner.
Are they getting pissed off out there?
I think they're getting a little... I think it's a little loud. It's fine. I
think we'll maybe just keep it at those two songs and we'll just kind of take it out.
Cool. Wait, can you go back to that story about getting the saxophones?
Yeah. When I was living in Portugal...
By the way, that sounded awesome.
Yeah, that sounded really good.
I just want to say that even though they went around and asked, everyone was like, no, we're totally cool with the music.
Really?
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. Okay, so you're in...
I was living in Portugal in 2007, and I literally received a phone call from somebody I didn't know, and he asked me, give me your address, and I said, why? And he's like, I'm in a divine mission, and you're the chosen. And, like, wow. I gave him my address, and a week later, this fucking crazy saxophone arrived. It's a con, it's 60 years old, it's, like, a really rare saxophone that all the, like, famous saxophone players played on. And... then I came to New York, and I actually got to meet the guy that gave me the saxophone.
Mm-hmm. Wait, how did he hear about you, though?
I played a jazz festival in Portugal, and a friend of his saw me and told him about me. And then I got to meet Miguel, finally, in New York, and he's, like, a really cool guy. He's a saxophone player himself, who got a lot of money by doing a translation company. And he's the most generous, amazing guy. And... I just mentioned, like, I just asked him, like, what kind of brand of baritone saxophone should I get? I'm, like, thinking about buying a cheap one. And he's like, oh, you want a Barry? And I'm like, yeah. I have a Mark VI. Those are 12 grand. They cost 12 grand. There's this one right here.
It's, like, the best one.
He's like, yeah, I have it in Valencia right now. I get it to you by the end of the month. And he did. And then we played a party at his house, and he took... Well, Mike, do you want to tell that story?
Yeah, so we played a party at Miguel's house on his roof, and you know, just having a good time. And then after we played, he's like, "Hey, Mike, I just bought a Sonny Stitt's horn off eBay."
Sonny Stitt is a really famous saxophone player.
Yeah, like from way back. He's like, "You want to check it out?" I said, "Yeah, obviously." So I go down, and he's like, "Why don't you play it? If you fall in love with it, you can have it." It's like, "Oh my god, okay."
So, who is this guy?
Jesus.
A good man.
He's the saxophone Jesus. But, so we went to his room, and, like, a bunch of people came, and I played it, and I loved it. You know, it was just, like, the best one I ever played. And gave it to me that night. It was a trip. It was pretty weird.
Yeah. That was crazy.
The look on your face was amazing.
Mike started crying, I think.
Yeah. I cried a little bit.
Yeah, I would cry too. I would have cried too. That's amazing. And it also, you know, shaped two-thirds of the band.
Yeah.
And the sound, like...
It's all... I mean, vintage saxophones that we could never afford.
That one's from 1941.
Yeah.
And it's all coming from these two. Like, you couldn't recreate this with cheaper horns.
No, you could, but...
Not the same quality.
I mean, you can't... I mean, you can't
replace
a Mark VI, you know? You can't replace a Con.
Yeah.
It's amazing. So, you know, why don't you guys tell us about, you know, you have a show coming up in April, right?
Yeah, April 13th.
Knitting Factory.
Yeah.
Is it just you guys or is anybody else playing?
It's just us. And it starts at 12 a.m., so...
Midnight.
Oh, amazing. And then...
is that the Thursday night or the Friday night?
Yeah, that's the confusion, but it's Friday night.
Okay,
yeah,
you can buy tickets online at Ticketfly.
I usually just try and tell people it starts at 11:59 on Friday night.
Yeah, right. I know, 11:59.
Because then...
It always gets confusing, yeah. 11:59 and then they don't Friday night.
11:59, 59 seconds, you know.
Yeah, might be a second 59 late. Seconds, exactly.
Yeah. We take this age. And then you guys have one record out already?
Yeah.
Where can you get that?
Yeah. You can get it on Bandcamp.
Yeah.
On iTunes, you can get it on Amazon.
Anything that you can buy CDs on.
Spotify, anything really.
Amazing. And then you said you have another record coming out.
Well, it's not coming out, it's just being produced right now by us.
We have about probably 23, 24 songs.
Yeah, we have
songs.
Another 12 songs.
Amazing.
But what we want to do for our next album, this album is totally acoustic everything, and for the next album we want to elaborate on the sound a little bit, you know? Like,
we want to start incorporating electronic effects.
Or we've been also going to junkyards collecting metal, and, you know, we're planning on building percussion racks, and, I don't know, we maybe even incorporate, like, some rhythmic samples of a subway train, going through the tunnel in Bedford, you know?
Got
cut it.
It
up, make a drum set out of it, just like we want to experiment a lot with it and surprise our fans with our next album.
That's awesome. Bigger band?
Yeah, we'll be expanding the band.
We're gonna have some guests. We're gonna have a rapper. We're gonna have a singer that we're actually working on with right now already, and we're also gonna invite 5 saxophone players for 1 song or 2.
Amazing. Wow.
Yeah.
All right. So, why don't you give the nuts and bolts of where to find you guys online, Twitter, email, bookings, all that stuff.
Yeah, you can see us online. Facebook Moon Hooch or Twitter Moon Hooch, moonhooch.com or moonhooch.bandcamp.com. Just Google us. We're on YouTube.
Awesome.
Awesome. So I think we're going to have to call it today.
Yeah.
This is the first time that's actually 2 of the owners are sitting out there. All the times that have come to play.
We'll do 1 more.
Is Roberto out there?
We're good on 1 more, guys.
Oh, we are good on 1 more?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay. Great. All right. So on the show. So thank you to everybody who was on the show today. Thank you for the fried chicken sandwiches from Smith Canteen, Searsucker. Are you going to be here next week?
No, I'll actually be gone for the next few weeks. Next week, Jack, you'll be happy about this. It's a DJ set. Lemonade, our good friends Lemonade are going to come back. They're going to play a DJ set, talk about the new record they have coming out in May. And then, we'll be back with some more episodes of Snacking Tunes. And I'll be back in a few weeks.
Sweet.
Okay.
Well, okay.
You going to be okay?
I guess.
I'll hug you after this.
All right.
Okay.
I didn't know you were going to be missing so many weeks.
Surprise.
Awesome.
Yeah. Anyway.
Okay. Well, I'll be here.
For this next one, we're going to...
What is that?
Wenzel's sticking a cardboard tube in his saxophone, in the bell of the saxophone, to lower the pitch of the horn.
Yeah,
so
it makes the lowest note, a -6 lower.
And we're going to try and emulate some dubstep.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, here we go.
So sorry, owners of...
No, it's fine. Hey, they gave us the sign-off. Moon Hooch on Snacky Tunes. I'll see you next week. Greg will not. Have fun at Coachella.
I'll try.
Okay, bye.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
This program is powered by Simplecast.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.